This podcast is part of the Shareable Podcast Network. Learn more at shareable.fm. Not every guest takes me up on the opportunity, but I like to do a segment called The Mic Swap, where I make my guest into the host, and then I become the guest. I let them take the conversation wherever they want to take it, ask me whatever they want, and it's a lot of fun, I think. This is Mic Swap.
Hi, this is Jeff Madoff, and I'm the host of the Shareable Podcast, and I've got a guest I've been looking forward to talking to for quite a long time, mainly because we share the same first name. And I try to have as many guests as I can that have the first name Jeff. And today, I'm very fortunate to have Jeff Gibbard. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thanks so much for having me. And that is a really good idea. What if we just had a podcast called the Jeff Cast? And the only rule was that the guest's first name had to be Jeff, or last name Jefferson or something like that. But I think that we should run with that. Let's talk about it offline.
Okay. So, Jeff, I know that you're an entrepreneur, and that's a term that's been bandied about quite a bit, especially in the last few years. And I think COVID has also accelerated the move for a lot of people towards entrepreneurship. But what I wanted to ask you is, what is an entrepreneur? How would you define that?
So I think there's the common usage, and then there's my usage. I would say in the common usage, it's somebody who has, they see something in the world that they want to change, and they figure out a way to make that change and build a business around it. Like, I think that's kind of the kind of boring generic version. To me, I think of entrepreneurialism more of like a character trait, because for me, it's not as much about money or business. Like, I'm kind of an anti-capitalist entrepreneur because it's not really about making money. And it's certainly not about like scaling a unicorn. None of that's appealing to me. I think of an entrepreneur as someone who sees a change in the world and wants to make a change and wants freedom in their life. I think that the freedom part is what I identify with the entrepreneur. It's the freedom from control. It's the freedom to choose to pursue different ideas and things that you want to do. So I think entrepreneurialism is a mindset of seeing something you want and going after it. That's how I relate to it personally.
So when you talk about, you know, wanting to make some kind of change, what are you talking about?
It's going to be different for everyone, but for me, you know, and I think you and I share this, is you kind of have to ask why you're doing things. And at the core for me is I want my life to be a life of impact. I want my meaning, my existence on this planet to have a meaning to it. I want there to be an impact left in my wake. And for me, that means making a world that is kinder, safer, more equitable, jobs that we like going to more, people feeling like they're more free to be who they are and express themselves in whatever way they feel mirrors their true identity. So for me, when I think about the changes I want to make, it's I'm looking for ways to give people permission to do the things that they want to do and to give them the tools to grow in to the capability to do the things that they want to do in life. And I think if I can do that with enough people, I can facilitate some pretty remarkable changes in the world.
Well, one of the things that you did is you started a podcast, and that gave you a platform to not only get out your own ideas, but expose the ideas of others. Why did you start the podcast? And is doing a podcast something ultimately that worked out the way you hoped, work out differently, but you loved it? Or, you know, what was your idea and what was the actualization and what was the gap between the two?
So I would say that almost everything that I've done, I've sort of fallen ass backwards into it being successful, financially meaning successful, because I didn't set out intentionally for a lot of the things that I do to be financially successful. Mostly I'm just a little bit of a brat and I just like to do things that I want to do. So why I started the podcast, truly, honestly, deeply, I like talking to interesting people. And when you have a podcast, you can get all sorts of amazing people to come on and talk to you for like an hour. And that's amazing. Like, it's a cheat code. And I don't know why everybody doesn't do it, because the people that I've gotten to talk to and the experiences I've gotten to hear and the things that I've been able to learn from them, priceless. And yet I didn't have to pay a dime for any of it. People volunteered to come on and let me ask them questions. And I love asking questions. And I am incredibly curious, and learning is one of my favorite things in the world. So if you can bring me an amazing person and just let me pick at them and ask them questions, it's like a gift. So I started it because I wanted to learn and I wanted to talk to amazing people. The side benefits of it were that it's made me a considerable amount of money indirectly. Sometimes people who were guests became clients. Sometimes they referred me work. Sometimes it led to speaking engagements. You know, there's all sorts of things like that. I've also put my ideas out there, and, you know, despite all of the, you know, the attention that engagement gets in social media and content marketing, more often than not, it's the people that don't say a word that are the ones that lead to real true success. Just the people watching, the people quietly, passively consuming your content that are like, oh, hey, I've been listening to your show for the last 3 years and it's great. I'm like, huh? I didn't even know you existed. And, you know, I think for me, the thing that has been most rewarding outside of the great conversations is just all of the unexpected benefits that have come from putting your ideas out in the world, being honest about what's important to you, and just putting it out there and seeing what happens, you know, just leaving it up to chance almost.
You've had an impressive roster of guests. How do you get them?
So here's my 10-step process. It's very simple. First, I ask them, and then they usually say yes. And then I send them a form and they have to go through the other 7 steps.
Well, what is the ask?
The ask is like, hey, you're super interesting. I would love to have you on my podcast and talk to you about what you do. And so like, it's not always the same, you know, like I get people that recommend guests to me all the time. So somebody like, you know, I have a friend of mine, Jeff Harry, who I met through somebody else.
Keep his name separate, by the way. So we have another Jeff podcast.
Yeah, he should be on Jeffcast though. He has a company called Rediscover Your Play, and it's all about finding play and creating psychological safety at work and being free to play so you can bring out your best creativity. Great guy. But he recommended me like 5 guests recently. And he was a guest that was recommended to me by another guy who recommended me like 4 or 5 guests. I still haven't even had him on. But the point being is it's sort of like a bit of a network effect. When you start a podcast and you're a relatively good interviewer, as I believe I am, other people who are your guests go, you know, you're a good interviewer. I have somebody else you might want to talk to who's really interesting. Would you be interested in talking to them? And I'm like, sure, because I like interesting people. So a lot of my guests came by way of that. And it's sort of this thing where, and I think you've experienced this in your class, where when you kind of work your way into a network, all of a sudden that network kind of opens up to you. It's like, all you have to do is get your foot in the front door of that network. And then the people that are in that network open you up to their network. And I've found that that's mostly how my podcasting has worked in terms of getting guests. I get guests sent to me in some channels, some through referrals. And then a lot, I just reach out to someone. I'm like, you are just profoundly fascinating. And I think that you should be on my show so that I can talk to you. I'll give you an example. I've got, and I can't announce this officially yet, but I have an author who, he wrote a book that's in like my top 10 of all time, probably even top 5, depending on the category we're talking about, but it's an essential book about trust. And I recently just cold reached out to him and I was like, I love your book. It's on my like short list. You're on my short list to endorse my book. And I would love to talk to you and just not even talk about my book or any of my stuff, but just talk about you and what you've done because it was such an inspiration to me. And he was like, yeah, that sounds good. And that's how it kind of works.
So
it's how it's worked for me.
Let's go back in time now, because you are, you know, when you talk about interesting people, what you get from that, how you love learning, all of those things. Let's go back to Jeff as a kid. And would we see any indication of what it is you're doing now when you were a kid?
I think not a person on this planet would be surprised to see me doing exactly what I'm doing today if they met me when I was a kid. Even down to what I'm wearing would give it a bit. It would be a dead giveaway. So as a kid, I was hyperactive, superhero obsessed, and just... at that age, I wasn't yet destroyed by school. And I say destroyed very lovingly, and not that like all education is bad or anything, but it wasn't designed for people like me. So I have ADHD and I learn a very particular way. And my brain moves really fast. and I pick up things really fast. So I was bored through most of school, and I found busy work to be boring and needlessly pointless. But I could ace a test just by being in class, just absorbing, right? So fast forward to today, and what do? Well, I had no respect for authority, like zero. So me, an entrepreneur who writes a book on leadership, how to create companies where people who are entrepreneurial and have trouble with authority would love to work, which is what my book is about, The Lovable Leader. It's like, how do you create a company that I would work at? Who has a company called the Superhero Institute, where I show people how to unlock their gifts and natural abilities through a very straightforward process. Yeah, not a single bit of it would be a surprise. And I wear superhero shirts every single day of my life.
So was that a conscious decision going in the direction you're going? Or as you look back, did you connect the dots and say, you know, this makes perfect sense. This is what I love.
It's a bit of both. So if you look at why, like what I've always wanted to do, in every single thing, a bit of it has been about following something I'm interested in, right? Like that's always been somewhere in there. Another piece of it has been doing something where I can make a profound impact, right? Like all of the career choices I wanted, I want to do something big and profoundly impactful, like nothing passive or average. And then I wanted things that specifically in their impact would make changes that would ideally help people feel seen for who they are and for how they are, right? Because again, I felt very left out in school. I felt like I was dumb and I felt like I was average and I felt like I was all of these things. And it wasn't until I was able to give myself the liberty to embrace what made me unique that I felt like a person, like I felt validated, right? And I want everyone to feel that. So to a certain extent, it was always present as an undercurrent, but specifically as it relates to, for instance, like the superhero connection, that was more of a, it was there and I didn't see it. And my wife pointed it out to me. And at first I was like, nah, you're crazy. No one will take me seriously with superheroes. And then I went and I talked to a whole bunch of people that I really respect. And it was a theme that kept coming up again and again and again and again, superpowers. You know, you're like a superhero to these people and, you know, it, blah, 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 blah. It kept coming up and I was like, all right, so that's there. So yeah, I think to a certain extent, it's a little bit of both. A little bit was conscious and a little bit was just there.
So you talked about two things I want to expand on a little bit. And one of those is, you know, you felt stupid and people made you feel stupid. Everyone experiences doubt. How do you keep moving forward? And how did you deal with that emotional obstacle that was in the way?
I think I've had my relationship to doubt has changed over time. Because I think for a while I processed doubt as more of an external phenomenon, that if other people outside of me doubted it, it was because there was something that they knew about me that I didn't recognize and that, you know, obviously they know, right? So, you know, I've always had profound belief in myself, but I've also been given a lot of signals. And this is where I think school was challenging for me. School taught me that I was very average. It taught me that I wasn't going to be very successful in a career because I didn't fit into any of these nice, neat little buckets, right? I didn't do things the way that it was prescribed in these institutions. And for that reason, I felt like, well, I'm going to do it anyway, even though the system's telling me that I'm not going to be very good at. But it was always a lingering doubt. And again, it wasn't until at some point in my life that I decided to shed the belief that that had any validity, that like anybody got to tell me what I was going to be capable of or not capable of. Once I shed that, I think I no longer actually struggle with doubt as an external phenomenon. Now we all struggle with like the imposter syndrome and the doubt on that side. And I think as it relates to the question of whether or not I'm capable of doing something, I generally just believe there's no evidence to support one way or the other. And the only way you're going to know is if you try. There's that quote by Steve Jobs where he said, you know, the people that you admire, I'm paraphrasing it, but like, all the great people that did things that you wish you did are no different than you and I. They just decided to do it. That's like the big difference, right? And I know that that's a phenomenon that you or an idea that you tinker with a lot. But I just believe you don't know until you do it and just do it. So I think I get myself over the hump that way. It doesn't stop me from the beating myself up and the rugged, self-criticism that we all put ourselves through, and I particularly put myself through, but it does at least give me an antidote to it, which is like, look, you don't really know if you can do it or not. So just go do it. Get up, go do it.
So you mentioned a phrase that I'd like you to first define for our listeners and then tell me how that impacted you. And that's imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of this goes back to the belief that I was average and not smart, that I passively learned through the process of formalized education. And I think a lot of that, anytime I did have any success, the imposter part was the belief that I wasn't supposed to be there because I was told I wasn't supposed to be there. Not directly. No one ever said, Jeff, you're stupid. But they say, oh, he doesn't live up to his potential. Or, you know, the grades would tell me that, like, you know, you get a C or a D or a B in something. And it's like, well, obviously you're not as good as the A people. So you're just whatever. So I think a lot of my successes, I haven't been able to truly appreciate because I'm so stuck in the, I'm not supposed to be here. This must be some sort of mistake. So I define imposter syndrome as just the feeling that despite the evidence that it's all actually incorrect, that's all been a big mistake and that you don't actually belong there.
And so putting yourself out there is a form of risk. How do you define risk?
I define risk as not taking the chance because I'm not risk averse. I'm very risky in how I do things. And the risk has to be calculated and has to be nested in my values and purpose. Like, I don't just take risks for no reason, but if it's something where I feel that it's, you know, in line with my purpose of making an impact and doing good in the world, then I'm going to do it. Even if it appears risky. I think the riskiest thing is doing nothing at all, to look back on your life and see all of the things that you could have done had you just taken the chance at something. And I don't know, I told this story before in a variety of different ways, but like, I've always had a very interesting relationship with the concept of death and mortality and legacy and things like that. My dad was a funeral director. My mom got into a catastrophic car accident on my last day of high school. She survived, but like, her life was never the same. But you know, whatever she was intending to do before that was no longer an option. And I think about that all the time. I think about, I have all these things that I want to do. And I every once in a while fall into this trap of thinking like, oh, well, I have tomorrow. But there's an urgency that drives me because I don't know that I have tomorrow. And I think for that reason, my relationship to risk, and the risk of putting myself out there and any of that is dwarfed entirely by the risk of not getting the opportunity to do that one more thing that could have solidified my impact or my legacy or making my life measure up to my expectations of what it's supposed to be at the end. I want to be able to look back and say, I left it all on the court. You know, like I played until the final bell. And that doesn't mean necessarily I'm exhausting myself. It just means that I was conscious about the effort that I was putting in to the story that is my life.
So, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. And one of the things I want to ask you about is, you now have a 19-month-old kid. You're married.
Mm-hmm.
How has that, or has it impacted at all how you work, the hours you put in, and other things you have to pay attention to? That classic, if you believe that it even exists, life-work balance.
I've had a pretty atypical schedule for a very long time. I'm also a night owl and I love doing my best work between like 10 PM and 2 AM. So, you know, I've been able to rearrange my schedule pretty easily. And, you know, I dictate my schedule to my clients. So I would say it hasn't been difficult from that standpoint. There are times where I feel the pull of the work, the life mission, right? The stuff that I want to be doing and making an impact. And at the same time, just sitting on the couch and watching Cocomelon with my daughter. You know what I mean? Like, that pull sometimes is difficult for me because I am, aggressively ambitious. And to just table that sometimes can be challenging. But I try to remind myself how important I am in this little child's life, that like, this is not every one of those Fridays that I take off with her is a moment for me to build deeper connection with her. And it's an opportunity. It's a chance that there's going to be a memory that she's going to hold on to for the rest of her life, positive or negative, that daddy was ignoring her, daddy was paying clear attention, or that we learned something together, or whatever it is. And that has been a little bit challenging to balance these two very strong draws for me, these two like desires to be in two places at once. But in terms of what I'm out to accomplish, being married and having this baby has only strengthened my resolve to make my life be an inspiration to her. And my wife is the absolute best partner I could imagine in terms of love and support and knowing what I'm out to do and being there for me every step of the way.
You know, you talk a lot about creativity and expression. And before we went on air, we had talked about a few things that you like doing, and writing and filmmaking and so on. How do you define creativity? What is creativity?
I think creativity is the ability to look at something that everybody else looks at and see something different. I think that's one aspect of it. And I think the other is kind of more baked into the name of it, creating. It is the ability to manifest something from, I don't want to say from nothing, because it comes from ideas, from thoughts, piecing together new things. So when you put those two things together, it's looking at something that everybody else sees and seeing it from a different perspective that's unique, and then creating something from that. So I see everything that I do as an act of creativity. I see everything that I do as trying to have my unique stamp on it, no matter what it is. If I make chicken parmesan and everybody else has made chicken parmesan before it, it's still not my chicken parmesan. That one that I made was mine. And that time that I made it on Tuesday, it's going to be different than the time that I make it next Wednesday. And each of those is a creative act, and it grows and becomes maybe a better result. But it remains a creative act because I am creating, and I'm always trying to look at that moment to create something.
So in other words, Jeff, we might see your next career as a chef.
I actually had a brief stint where I tried to start a personal chef service in Philadelphia called Rue In Home Fine Dining, because I've been cooking since I was 7 years old, maybe before that, but I've been cooking for almost all my life and I love it. And it's one of my favorite things in the world, because when I go in the kitchen, everything gets blocked out and I can just get really into the simple monotony of like dicing an onion. Like, it's just so calming and therapeutic and meditative. So, I've been really into cooking for a very long time. I've always loved looking at food in new ways and trying to combine flavors in my head. And I had a brief stint as a personal chef, and I didn't know enough about business to make it successful, but I'm a pretty damn good cook.
So finally, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to younger Jeff when he was starting out?
I guess it depends when we count starting out. You know, like, at what age are we talking about? Are we talking about like Jeff when I was, 3 years old and still wearing, a red towel around my neck thinking I was Superman? Or are we talking about me like right in college, fresh out of college?
Fresh out of college, when you're starting in your professional career.
Fresh out of college. I will say that I think no matter what I said to Jeff coming right out of college, I probably wouldn't have listened, because I don't think anybody coming right out of college for the most part is ready to hear the wisdom of their older self. But assuming in this scenario that I would listen to me, I would say start reading now. Like, read nonfiction specifically, because I didn't read for a very long time because I thought it like fiction was all that there was. And I just don't get into it. So, but nonfiction, once I got into that, it like changed my entire world. So I would tell myself to start reading nonfiction, develop a voracious appetite for reading, like read at least one book a month to start with and just keep going. So that'd be the first thing. Second thing is, I'd say you're not stupid. You're not stupid. You're actually very, very smart. You pick things up quickly. You just be comfortable in who you are and how you learn. Learn more about how you learn and how you think, and be okay with it as soon as possible. Because the sooner you do that, the sooner you're going to discover how to be successful. And then the third thing I would say, which I totally would not listen to, no question I wouldn't listen to it, is to be patient. Because it took me a long time of just beating my head against the wall and going after thing after thing after thing and failing and screwing up and doing dumb things, just awful, to finally get to a point where my career is amazing now. Like, I love what I do. I have a lot of freedom in what I do. I can turn away projects. I love the projects I'm working on. And if I had told myself what I do now, if I told myself coming straight out of college, that's what I do, I would have been excited about it, but I would have wanted it in like 6 months. And I wouldn't have recognized that it would have taken 20 years.
Yeah, I think that everything takes longer than we anticipate.
Much longer.
Yeah. So what would you say is the major obstacle that you had to overcome?
Ooh. If I'm being totally honest about this, I think it's that I have a conflict, an internal battle that is constant, that is always raging inside of me between undying belief in myself and in my ideas and in my purpose and in the long view of what I'll be able to accomplish, colliding with the pessimistic view that I'm going to fail at everything I ever do, that it'll never measure up to my expectations. And it's not failure in terms of like an objective failure, like that the thing just didn't work, but more that I will never reach the level to which I will consider a thing a success. That bar that I set for myself of what is successful is profoundly higher than anybody else from the outside looking in. And I think that that challenge for me has caused me to not necessarily appreciate my wins enough. It's caused me to potentially dwell on my losses a little too hard. It's caused me sometimes to stop taking risks that I otherwise would have. I'm not risk averse, but I think sometimes it probably scared me out of doing something I should have. And I think that that internal battle is probably the thing I struggle with most, is the simultaneous belief that I can do it and that I can't.
Well, this has been a great window into you, Jeff, and I really appreciate your time. And if I had to describe this episode in one word, that word would be shareable.
Wait, don't leave. If you've never listened to my fancy outro, do it just once for me, please. Okay, if you enjoy shareable and you find it valuable, there's a few ways that you can support the show. One, you can share it on social media, which I strongly encourage. I mean, it's literally the name of the show, shareable. Two, you can review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Overcast user, as many of my listeners are, make sure to click that star button on the episodes that you like. The third way that you can support the show is by blogging about it or discussing it on your own podcast, or even by making a YouTube video where you talk about one of the episodes. And then the final way that you can support the show is by supporting it directly on Patreon. You can find the link in the show notes. Now, before I let you go, I want to tell you about one other thing. You see, Shareable is just one of many projects that I'm working on at any given time. I've got another podcast called Rogue. I do a live streaming show every week called The Heroic Council. I've got a blog where I release a blog post twice a week. And if you're looking to keep up with all sorts of different content that can help you grow and become a superhero in life, I want you to check out jeffgibber.me. That's where I list all of my current projects and projects that are coming up in the future, including my forthcoming book, The Lovable Leader. It would mean a lot to me if you could go and check out some of the other things I've worked on, because I put just as much of my heart into those projects as I do into Shareable. Thank you so much for being a listener. Thank you for being a supporter, and I hope to see you here on the next episode of Shareable.